Case number 08-1134, et al. Christopher H. Zacharias, Petitioner versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Scott, for Petitioner Kaufman. Mr. Zisser, for Petitioner Zacharias. Mr. Burge, for Petitioner Carley. Mr. Quinn, for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Jeff Scott. I represent Petitioner Kaufman. I'd like to focus on two core issues this morning. Was Kaufman, the stockbroker, a necessary participant and substantial factor in the distribution of Starnet stock? And were the sanctions imposed, the disgorgement of $873,000 plus interest of $455,000, and the civil penalty of $110,000 justified in fact? The answer to those questions is no. First, Your Honors, this court has repeatedly said that the agency must identify what evidence was credited and what evidence was rejected in order for an agency decision to be sustained. The Supreme Court has said in the Bowman case that a party is entitled to be apprised of the factual material upon which the agency relies so he may rebut it. This court has said that a petitioner should not have to flail at the unknown in an attempt to prove the negative.
I thought here the key things were the relationship with Geiger, including 50-50 splitting of commissions in 1996 at least, and I believe the absence of any affirmative evidence of change since 1996.
We believe, Your Honor, the record is clear that there is no evidence to support the conclusion that those persons, Geiger and Kaufman, split commissions 50-50 at the time of these alleged wrongful acts. The only evidence...
Let's go back to... Do you accept the proposition that there was evidence for that for 1996?
We don't accept that. The only evidence in the record is what the administrative law judge said. The evidence was in the Kirby case, which related to activities in 1996. There's no independent evidence in this record at all on that subject. So the SEC, in its opinion, simply adopts what the ALJ said in the initial decision, which is not based on anything in the record in this case at all. So it seems to me inescapable to conclude there is zero evidence to support in this case that Geiger and Kaufman split commissions 50-50.
Even in 1996?
The only reference in the record is to the Kirby decision, and there's no affirmative evidence other than that in this record.
But that indicates that, as Judge Williams suggested, correct, that in 96 they were splitting commissions.
That's what the Kirby court said. I don't know about the record.
Why isn't that enough to discharge the commission's initial burden of going forward, such that with absent any sort of suggestion that relationship was changed, it's reasonable to infer that it continued.
I think, with respect, it is not reasonable to confer that it continued. It was far distant in time, at least 2 years earlier, and the first time that...
Well, your folks had the relevant evidence, and they didn't put it in.
It didn't become an issue until the initial decision was announced in July of 2005, 6 months after the hearing. There was no suggestion at the hearing by the enforcement division or in any other way that that would be an issue. It could have been put in.
And did you seek any reconsideration on that point?
No.
Okay. You're in your rebuttal time if you want to preserve it.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Zisser. I represent Christopher Zacharias. The SEC found that Mr. Zacharias, a former officer of StarNet, which was at the time a successful internet company, committed securities fraud, filed false reports with the SEC, and sold unregistered securities. With respect to the fraud claim, the false statement found to have been made by Mr. Zacharias was a statement in a Form 10-K and repeated in an amended Form 10-K filed shortly thereafter, that StarNet had nothing to report under Item 404 of Regulation SB, which relates to the disclosure of related party transactions. In fact, the SEC's decision did not find that StarNet was a party to a related party transaction, which is what Item 404 required at the time to be disclosed, but merely that it had arranged such a transaction. So on the face of it, the statement that the SEC found to be false was not false. The SEC's determination that the statement was material was based upon a so-called potential future event, exposure to subsequent lawsuits by certain purchasers. However, the SEC failed to do the analysis required by the Supreme Court in Basic versus Levinson, which is essentially to evaluate the impact of a potential future event on a company as discounted by the likelihood of the event occurring. Not only didn't the SEC...
Excuse me, the potential future event being what, a rescission suit?
Correct. The potential event being rescission suits and then the likelihood. Had that analysis been performed, it would be clear that there was no exposure to loss from potential rescission suits because there was no potential plaintiff in such rescission suits. The open market purchasers would not have had a claim against StarNet because StarNet didn't sell those shares directly. There were intermediaries, and as the Supreme Court pointed out in Basic versus Levinson, there's no claim under Section 12.1 of the 33 Act against a seller. So not only didn't they both failed to analyze the issue under Basic, But had they, the record is clear that there was no exposure. So the fraud claim fails on materiality grounds as well.
Where is this point in your brief? I wanted to comment on something in there.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where is this point made in your brief? I know it's in here, but I'm just trying to find it.
Probably about page 22, which is where I cite Basic.
Right.
Yes. And then going on, beginning on page, well, actually, it probably begins at the very bottom of page 21 and then goes on to the argument continues on through page 24.
But here's the government's response, I think. This is at 40 in their brief. In light of the concealed dilution resulting from the public distribution of StarNet shares and the potential rescission liability, a reasonable investor would consider starting this distribution of a large number of shares without registration as significantly altering the total mix of information, et cetera. That goes to materiality.
Correct.
Now, discounting the potential rescission liability for the reasons you've just given, what about the seeming dilution of the shares?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First, the SEC never found that the so-called misrepresentation was material because of any issues relating to dilution. That's something that the commission's attorneys argued in their brief subsequently, and as the court has held repeatedly and the Supreme Court has held, the sufficiency or the validity of the SEC's opinion is based on what the SEC gives as its reasons, not what its lawyers give later. Secondly,
if they come back and tell us that it really is there in some inchoate form, then what?
Well, then I think the answer is that, in fact, the amount of sales was disclosed. So there was disclosure of the dilution. The officers had to file forms four, and there is no suggestion that those forms weren't filed, you know, relating to their sales. Further, the options program was also disclosed. So the market, I mean, there is no basis to conclude that the market was uninformed of both the potential for and the actuality of the sales that might have had a dilutive effect had the SEC grounded its materiality decision on that as well. I see that my time is up, and I will reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sisson.
May it please the Court, Thomas D. Burge on behalf of defendant or respondent John Carley. I'd first like to follow up on Mr. Zisser's comment about the statements in the 10-K because his argument applies equally to Mr. Carley. The argument about material applies just as well to Mr. Carley. The additional issue on behalf of Mr. Carley is the evidence of intent. The Commission found that Mr. Carley intentionally committed fraud or violated the anti-fraud provisions when the annual report was filed. The opinion only finds that Mr. Carley was aware that there was an option plan and that he had signed an authorization that allowed this broker in Vancouver to handle the mechanics. There's not a finding in the conclusion or in the opinion anywhere that Mr. Carley knew that this Mr. Pieper was involved in any of these transactions, that any of his entities were involved in any of the transactions. In fact, there's affirmative evidence in the record to the contrary, which is
Mr. Carley is not a recipient of the Broverone memo.
He is not, Your Honor.
Okay.
In fact, he had never heard the name Broverone until sometime in October of 1999. The testimony that was unrebutted at the hearing was that Mr. Carley had not met Mr. Broverone, had not met Mr. Pieper, had not met Mr. Gould prior to the transactions being affected, and wasn't involved in structuring the mechanics or any of the mechanical aspects of the process. And that is precisely what the Commission finds was material. That is, the issue, the fact that's going to give rise to the rescission is the involvement of Mr. Pieper and his people. And clearly, there's no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence is just to the contrary, that Mr. Carley was aware of any of that.
Didn't he sign some sort of irrevocable authorization?
It's an irrevocable authorization that is similar to ones that are used in other kinds of option plans, but in nowhere does it mention the mechanics of...
Whom did it authorize to do what?
It authorized the broker in Vancouver to handle the transactions, and it also...
The Spencer firm?
No, it's... His name is Gould.
Oh, the individual.
The individual.
Isn't he at Spencer?
No, he's at a brokerage firm in Vancouver, British Columbia, the name of which I don't know.
So he irrevocably authorized Gould in Vancouver to do what?
To transfer shares on his behalf, and he also authorized...
For whom?
I don't think it says, Your Honor. It certainly doesn't mention Mr. Pieper or any of his entities.
Okay. At this point, Carley was chairman of the company, is that right? Chairman of the board of directors?
At one point in time, yes, Your Honor, he was chairman of the board.
At this time? At this time when he didn't know anything?
Well, we're talking about a year, and he became chairman during that year. So, in effect, he was chairman for many of his sales.
Mm-hmm. So, basically, he signed this document not knowing, did it have any blanks in it?
It did have some blanks in it, Your Honor. He signed it based on advice from both in-house counsel and outside counsel that this was the mechanism that had been established to allow every employee to exercise their options, not just Mr. Carley.
Do you have an opinion letter?
There was no opinion letter, but there was oral advice from both Mr. Zacharias and from outside counsel.
They both testified?
Mr. Zacharias testified, yes, Your Honor.
That he gave that opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. He testified that he structured the transaction and he believed that they were legal, and he informed Mr. Carley to that effect.
Does his testimony describe the structure of the transaction?
At one point in time during his testimony, he described the structure of the transaction, but he did not testify that he described that transaction to Mr. Carley. So there's no testimony from anyone that says Mr. Carley was aware of the specific mechanics of the option exercise or how the stock was eventually to be sold. I see I've gone over my rebuttal time.
We'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. Randall Quinn for the SEC. Your Honors, petitioners have not addressed the Section 5 violations and the exemptions. The Commission has explained those in some detail in its opinion. If the Court has no questions about how it worked and why the transactions were not exempt from registration, then I will go directly to the points that petitioners have just raised today. Let me just take them in the order that they were presented. With respect to the disgorgement as to Mr. Kaufman, there was, in addition to the evidence we talked about, the prior 50-50 split. The ALJ did rely on evidence in this case, and
the evidence of the 50-50 split comes from outside the case, correct?
No, it comes from both this prior arrangement and, in this case, the evidence that the ALJ considered was that there was an arrangement between Kaufman and Geiger to share expenses in the same proportion as commissions. And this is evidenced in Joint Appendix page.
That's quite different from a 50-50 split.
There's another leg to my argument. There is also evidence that Kaufman paid Michaels, an assistant to Geiger and Kaufman, 50% of his salary. So there's an agreement they will share expenses in the same proportion as commissions. They have an expense, they have an assistant, a person named Mr. Michaels, and there's evidence that Kaufman paid 50% of that. The only other point I would make out is the ALJ.
It's a joint assistant.
Yes, yes, an assistant
to
both.
Their expenses.
Yes.
And they're splitting that expense.
Yes.
And there's an agreement that they'll split expenses as they split commissions.
Yes, and I would direct you to Joint Appendix page 150, where the ALJ discusses this, and Joint Appendix page 1469. Turning to the argument made about materiality. The Commission found that on materiality, the failure to disclose these related party transactions hid a scheme to illegally distribute StarNet stock. Hiding that scheme had several consequences. One that the Commission pointed to was a potential rescission action.
We say one that it pointed to. Just to clear this up, did it point to anything else?
That is the one that it pointed to.
So that's what we have before us.
Correct, but
that's all we have before us, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Something lurking in the SEC's mind doesn't count.
It does not count. However,
something that you thought of that they should have thought of doesn't count.
I think that here's the way I would like the court to look at this. The key to the materiality finding is that you're hiding a scheme to illegally distribute stock. Now, I would agree the commission did not spell out every consequence of that. The one consequence
about materiality, that with respect to materiality, the consequences that count are the consequences the commission discussed, right?
Yes. The commission then, I will let me defend the point about potential rescission actions. The key thing here for materiality, you need to look at it at the time of the misleading statement or at the time of the material omission. So at that time, the commission found you are hiding a scheme to illegally distribute stock. The commission says that exposes the company to potential rescission actions.
By who?
By purchasers of the Starnet stock. In this case, that would be the PIPER entities. It would be the person.
It has to be a purchaser from Starnet.
That's right, because under 12A1, there is a requirement, there is a privity requirement.
Right.
And if you look at it, at the time of the misleading omission, there might have been rescission actions. In other words, you're a reasonable investor. At that time,
PIPER.
Sorry?
PIPER is the one we're talking about, right? The PIPER's entities.
No, I think we're talking about any Starnet shareholder. If you're a shareholder.
Who purchases from Starnet?
Let me try to separate this. I think there are two points here. The one point, who could bring a rescission action? That's a limited class.
Right.
However, if you're a shareholder of a company, any shareholder, and the company is exposed to rescission actions, then that affects you as an innocent shareholder.
You're still trying to establish the predicate that the company is exposed. And you said, well, look at it at the time.
Correct.
We're doing that. What do we see if we look at it at the time?
You see that shares of stock are being sold in violation of Section 5, and the purchasers of those shares, in this case, the PIPER entities, have a potential rescission action. Now, it may
be a strong position to start a rescission action? I mean, it seems to me the facts laid out by the commission put the PIPERs right at the center of the scheme. They're in it from day one, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
It doesn't sound like a terribly risky proposition for the company, does it?
Well, I would just fall back on the idea of a potential rescission action and that should not be.
Rescission action, regardless of its conceivable merits.
It should not be viewed in hindsight.
I understand that. I understand your argument in the footnote is perfectly okay, that we look at it at the moment the decisions are being made. But at the moment the decisions are being made, by the commission's account, the PIPER's entities and the respondents here are in it all up to their necks, right? No?
That would be if you're looking at a rescission action, what you're getting into.
Which is the only thing the commission wants us to look at.
Yes. What you're getting into is, would there be an in pari delicto defense that could be asserted against the PIPER entities to preclude their rescission? And my response simply is, I'm not sure on these facts. Yes, it looks like it would be difficult for the PIPER entities to maintain that lawsuit, but I don't know.
The rescission is here. It's the sole basis, and it's rested on by the commission completely without regard to probability of success. I mean, anyone can sue for rescission. I can sue Starnet for rescission. I've never seen a share of it in my life, but I could sue. But do I have a chance of winning? Zero.
Well, I would not concede that it's a zero chance. I was talking
about my own chance in the hypothetical suit against Starnet.
Never having been a shareholder.
Right.
I don't think I'm giving anything up in that hypothetical. No, but.
No, I don't.
But, again, if we're looking at it from the overall group of Starnet shareholders, What are you concerned about? Concerned about the company concealing this illegal scheme that might expose it to rescission actions. Maybe there's a small chance.
Suppose that the public is unaware that the Pieper Group has unclean hands and almost certainly no action for rescission. Maybe they've even renounced any right to an action for rescission, but the public doesn't know that. So, and then the disclosure is omitted. I mean, it's not omitted. This was a transaction with a related party. Is that still a material omission? You see what I'm getting at? That could the effect on the public and on purchasing decisions be material, even if it's based on a faulty premise, but nonetheless would be out there, would be what the public would see it.
I think that could be material.
That the public gets later revealed to the public that there was an illegality, but without any facts associated with the illegality that would enable them to assess the risks to the company. Right. So, in other words, the hypothesis is that the people interested in the StarNet market get a completely bowdlerized picture of the illegality.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, Your Honor, I would.
It comes
I would
out
say
that there's a related party transaction or something that should have been disclosed and wasn't, but it doesn't come out that there's no potential plaintiff.
I would fall back on, don't want to repeat myself, but a reasonable investor in StarNet, a reasonable innocent investor at that time would consider that somehow altered the mix of information that you would want to have if you're...
Purely alter is what's critical.
Well, yes, but I think the language is significantly altered, but the point, and again, it's a factual question. At the minimum, I would say there is substantial evidence here. It's for the trier of fact to determine. Let me move very briefly, if I may, to the Sander point, unless there were further questions on materiality. On the Scientra point with respect to Mr. Carley, it's important to focus on what the disclosure requirement was here. The disclosure requirement for related party was you're an officer and director, you're getting more than $60,000, and the issuer is a party. And there's no dispute that Carley was officer director at the time. There's no dispute that he knew he was getting $60,000. And I don't think there's a reasonable dispute.
He's getting $60,000 for what?
From the related party transactions. The related party transactions here are, you are really this whole scheme to exercise options. But the disclosure requirement that the fraud is based on says you have to disclose in this annual report. You have to disclose, is there a related party transaction? Are you a director? Did you get more than $60,000 from a transaction or series of transactions? And was the issuer a party? Those are the only three things that trigger a disclosure requirement. In this case, I think it's clear Carley knew those three things. He knows he's an officer director. He knows the series of transactions is more than $60,000. By the time of the annual report, he had gotten, I believe, the bulk of the $2.5 million that he got.
Are you asserting that the issuer is a party to the relevant transaction?
I am asserting that. I think it's when the commission finds the issuer arranges a series of transactions.
Well, under the current regulation, yes, but under the regulation as it then existed, it didn't say anything about arranging it, right?
Yes, if I could. Again, I actually have a second half of my response. If you arrange a series of transactions, and the commission describes these transactions, and they involve the issuer issuing stock to you upon exercising your option, I just think that is, just on any common sense view of the word party, you are a party. Even if the commission relaxed this requirement, it used to say party, now it says participant. The commission said, when it changed this after this case, it wanted to clarify that party is not limited to a...
So it was not pellucid at the time of these events that a non-party might be a participant.
I think that's why the commission clarified it, but to focus on these...
Before it's clarified...
Yes, that's what I'm getting to.
The lack of clarity goes directly to the issue of scienter, doesn't it?
I don't think there is any lack of clarity in this case because Starnet is a contractual party. There is an option agreement here, an agreement between Starnet and its officers. If you, an officer, pay Starnet the exercise price within certain conditions, you get the options. The series of transactions we're dealing with here involves Starnet issuing options to Carly pursuant to this option arrangement. So I don't think there is any confusion that Starnet is a party.
It issues options to Carly pursuant to the ESOP plan, doesn't it?
Correct.
Okay, and that's totally innocuous. It's only when the larger part of the larger scheme is put together that it becomes an issue. Right?
Yes, John.
And the issuer is not a party to the other parts of the scheme.
Well, no, Judge Ginsburg. As the commission found, what you have in this case is a single ongoing distribution of stock, which is illegal, which starts in January 1999 with the first option exercises. So the option exercises are part.
Exercise by whom?
By Carly and Zach. They're starting in February, so it's even easier. The commission said we have an ongoing illegal distribution starting with option exercises. The option exercises are part of the scheme to distribute. So as the commission also explained, you can't break up these various transactions into isolated components as they try to do. You have to consider the whole thing. There is a prearranged plan here.
Is it the case that the initial, not the distribution of these options, but the extension of the warrants, that it would have expired in 97, I think, extension to 98. Was there any consideration for that?
I do not believe there was any consideration.
Before you sit down.
Yes.
Can you call our attention to any case, this circuit or indeed any other circuit, that fits disgorgement under 2462, where the disgorgement is calculated simply as the gross proceeds of the transaction?
There are several. I don't believe there is a case in this circuit. I would have to refresh my memory about
cases that seem to actually bind us are cases like Bilzerian, although that's not in a 2462 context. It's in what appears to be a looser context. First City, where again the only issue is really what falls within the notion of disgorgement, but there we have a rather sensitive consideration of what the causal relationship is between the illegality and the gains. And I may say that in First City, I don't think there's even the remotest suggestion that the gross proceeds could be forced to be disgorged. And then, of course, you have the language in Johnson, which vacillates between insisting on pure remediation in the sense of recovering money that a victim has lost and the laxer concept of recouping ill-gotten gains. But First City and Bilzerian are both ill-gotten gains cases where a far more nuanced notion of causality is applied than what went on here.
If I could just take a minute to respond to this, I'm not aware of any Court of Appeals case directly addressing this situation because in most cases, disgorgement violations also go along with fraud violations that affect the value of a security. But I think that
makes your position harder, right?
It does, but there is, I believe, a district court case that's a pure Section 5 case.
Diversity is fraud. Bilzerian is fraud. So,
however,
in fraud cases, as I was saying, a much more nuanced calculation is made than the commission made here.
That explains the lack of direct precedent, but I think the calculation here is fully consistent with the rationale behind disgorgement as it's laid out in all the disgorgement cases. And the reason is Section 5 prohibited them from selling the stock, period.
Well, those cases, the law prohibited fraud in connection with transactions.
Yes, and it was measured in a case where the fraud is distorting the value, then that's how you can measure it. Here, I would say if Section 5 says you can't sell to the public, you sold to the public, the commission's starting point was disgorgement should be the total proceeds. It would then have been up to petitioners
even putting it that way, I don't see how you disregard the cost.
Well,
they have interesting issues about the calculation of the cost because there's out-of-pocket cost and there's opportunity cost. But let's put those aside. Nothing you've said suggests any reason to disregard cost.
I would say, rather than disregard, I would say it is up to the wrongdoer who has the burden of rebutting a commission showing to show in what way it should be reduced. Now, in this case,
I thought they did try to get the commission to at least remove the costs.
Well, they're...
In other words, if
not before
if someone commits a burglary, shouldn't they, and they're forced to disgorge the proceeds, shouldn't they get an offset for the burglar tools they had to buy and for the opportunity cost of their time when they could have been engaged in a legitimate activity? I think that's Justice Williams' question.
Not exactly. The position I'm taking has much more support in our cases.
Returning to Judge Williams' question, I think it's... this case has some...
Have you read First City?
I have. But I think...
In those cases, I think it's the case that the illegal act is not merely making the false statement, but then proceeding to engage in transactions. So the distinction you're trying to draw between an illegal transaction and fraud sort of floating about in the atmosphere doesn't seem to me to hold up.
Let me try one more approach to focus on this case. The commission, they did not spend any money out of pocket. The exercise price of the options was paid for with the legal proceeds. The commission is... But let me... I have a second...
So this depends upon they're not borrowing it from a bank or something? I mean, what sort of argument is that? I don't... What our cases, like Bilzerian and First City, talk about is a causal relationship between the illegality and some element of the proceeds.
Yes.
And the borrowing or paying the cost out of proceeds doesn't seem to me to match a causal connection theory at all.
If I have one more minute to try to answer this, the causal connection here is that Section 5 prohibits you from selling the stock to the public. Now, what petitioners at bottom are arguing is, well, we should get credit for what the stock is worth if we could have sold it privately. My response is, it is up to petitioners first to show that they could have sold the stock in some private transaction that the law allowed, and second, to show... Pardon me?
I thought if it was a private sale, it was exempt.
Well, I think in this situation, they would have to show, is there really a market? I think they would have to show, and it's their burden, first, that they could have found a buyer in a private transaction, and second, what would the stock have been worth if you sold it in a private transaction? If you found a buyer, if you had to wait
a year? The difference between that and a public offering is that the buyer would have a waiting period, is that correct?
if they used Rule 144 at that time, a one-year waiting period. I would point out, and the record shows, that approximately a year after the last sales here, the stock price was trading below the exercise price of the options. But again, just to sum up, our point here is that Section 5 says you can't sell it to the public. You get a pile of money. That's the starting point for a causal connection between your violation and your unjust enrichment. It is up to the wrongdoer to come back and present some evidence that, no, this stock was actually worth X because I could have sold it privately and I could have.
Suppose there was an option market in this stock, public market for future purchases. Right? So that would be a good proxy for what they could have gotten in a private sale.
If they had made a showing to the commission, that should be taken into effect. But again, they made no such showing before the commission on that.
The commission does acknowledge they did make a claim that the costs should be, at least the out-of-pocket costs should be considered, and the commission said no.
And there are a number of cases rejecting that very argument that you are not entitled to a deduction for expenses of carrying out an illegal scheme.
When the sales would have been saleable to the public, you said that at that point the shares were below the option price?
Approximately. Had they used Rule 144 at the time, that would have imposed basically a one-year waiting period with some limits. There is an exhibit in the appendix about the StarNet price, and around November 2000, it was dropping below the option price, and these sales concluded around August of 99.
What are these cases that say you don't consider the cost? Because it seemed to me, the main cases that you cite are Bilzerian and Banner, I think it was.
You're right, I actually don't have them on the top of my head, but there are a number of cases where an argument is made that the various costs in carrying out an illegal scheme should be subtracted from disgorgement, and the courts, not uniformly, but the very strong. I'm not sure if the circuit has
circuit cases, and they, in instances of what seems like far more reprehensible activity, they routinely allow the cost. They're often interesting arguments about how you calculate cost, but cost is routinely allowed.
I'm not sure if that issue has been squarely presented.
I think it's been squarely in the cases I've seen. It's been squarely presented and resolved against disregarding cost.
Well, then I would respectfully disagree with that, and I would point to the facts of this case.
Panel should disregard those cases.
Not if they're squarely on point. I don't remember the details of those cases. As I said, there is a substantial body of cases rejecting this argument. And in this case, I don't think you need to reach that question in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Quinn. Anybody have any time? Give everyone 2 minutes plus whatever they had remaining, so as not to reward those who went over more than those who didn't.
Your Honors, on the question of the 50-50 split in commissions between Geiger and Kaufman, I point out, and we point this out in our reply brief on pages 11 and 12, that the commission itself, through the enforcement division, having presented the case at trial and heard the evidence, proposed in its proposed findings of fact and its proposed disgorgement that they disregarded and rejected the 50-50 split idea, and the enforcement division proposed a 30% share of the commissions to Kaufman, resulting in the enforcement division's proposed finding number 476 in the amount of $508,043.
I guess the question remains whether there was substantial evidence to support what the commission ended up doing.
A fair point, and I think that a fair reading of the record in this case would lead to the conclusion that it does not, that it is bordering on speculation based on a past event. And if you look at the record as a whole, I suggest that there is not that substantial evidence. And I make the point again that the commission itself in its opinion refers to nothing in the record. In the cases we cite in our brief, and I'm thinking of the Burlington Truck Lines case by the Supreme Court that says to allow an agency to do this would create a monster without a reason. And that's the Supreme Court talking. And I suggest respectfully that that should be the approach to this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Mr. Zisser? No, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to who could be a potential plaintiff in a case going to the issue of materiality, really the potential plaintiff would be on the rescission issue. It wouldn't be even be Mr. Pieper. The potential plaintiffs would be the StarNet officers and employees who sold to Mr. Pieper. So, you know, the way the transaction went was StarNet sold to their officers, say Mr. Zacharias. Mr. Zacharias essentially sold to Mr. Pieper. Mr. Pieper then sold. So that was the process that was described.
Isn't there the exercise of the warrants?
I'm sorry, the exercise of the warrants. So Mr. Zacharias exercised the warrants. Stock was issued in his name. That stock was transferred to Mr. Pieper, and then Mr. Pieper sold it. So the potential plaintiff would be at the Mr. Zacharias level, not at the Pieper level. Now, Mr. Pieper, even if he was deemed a potential plaintiff, in addition to having an impari delicto defense, Mr. Pieper didn't have any damages on a rescission claim because he sold it for a profit.
Yes, but the counsel makes the understandable argument that it should be viewed at the time the transactions are occurring, that is, say, the illegal transactions.
Even so, at that time, Mr. Pieper was selling at a profit.
Well, but someone who had received the notice that the commission says should have been given wouldn't know, isn't that right? Or even, let's see, maybe it's only Mr. Pieper we should be worried about, wouldn't know what price they're going to get when they sell.
Well, you know, please remember that the disclosure that forms the basis of the fraud claim came in August of 1999. This was after Mr. Zacharias' sales were completed. There were plenty of sales completed. If I might address the disgorgement issue, though.
Can we just go back? I'm sorry, and you ought to be given more time to respond to my question. We have no direct purchases from StarNet by the Pieper entities?
Not of the shares exercised from the options. There were direct purchases from the Pieper entities from StarNet when Pieper bought shares under the Regulation S offering in offshore, and when the Pieper entities exercised its warrants.
Right. But, okay. But so, I mean, viewing the commission's argument here charitably, it is that there's a potential Pieper rescission claim for which privity exists against StarNet.
Yes. Pieper could. That's. You're right. Pieper could have, Pieper would have the requisite privity to bring a claim with respect to shares it purchased from StarNet through the exercise of its options and warrants.
Your answer is no damages?
But that's certainly part of it. You know, I mean, there is the impari delicto defense, but there's more to it than just the impari delicto defense. You know, with respect to the disgorgement, and particularly with respect to Judge Ginsburg's burglary analysis, you know,
I wouldn't call that analysis.
Well, analogy.
Analogy.
You know, again, this—I mean, the general point is this is as nearly as I can tell a circumstance on disgorgement that's really never been addressed before. Here you have a situation where
that's contrary to Judge Williams' view.
Well, you know, it's, in a way, it's, you know, the cost issue has been addressed before. But here you have a situation where The sellers of the stock, Mr. Zacharias, came by the stock honestly. There was no violation of any kind with respect to his acquisition of the stock. The stock was, the value of the stock was completely unaffected by any wrongdoing. The company was very successful at a time when the market was highly valuing companies at this time that even weren't successful. And there was no suggestion anywhere in the in the record at all that the increase in price in any way.
I understand that, but it seems to me our cases have been uncertain on the question of whether disgorgement can be exclusively for some sort of actual harm, or whether it can be disgorgement of, and the great metaphor is, ill-gotten gains, and at least taking the broader view, the ill-gotten gains metaphor, gains from a violation of Section 5 would count.
Well, you know, the one question is it a gain? If you have stock worth a dollar and you sell it for a dollar, albeit in violation of Section 5, is that an ill-gotten gain? You have a change in asset.
Our cases go with some sophistication into the question of cost.
Correct.
Of
Correct. Now, the way that I look at it, and perhaps this hopefully will be helpful to the court, is as I read the Patricia Johnson case, what distinguishes disgorgement from a penalty is where there's a return to the status quo. Now, in a situation where somebody comes by stock through a violation or holds something and sells it for a price that is affected by a violation, requiring a disgorgement of those proceeds does, in fact, involve a return to the status quo, because but for the violation he wouldn't have had the stock, or but for the violation he wouldn't be able to sell it. Here, you can't. Mr. Zacharias had a significant amount of stock worth a significant amount of money. He can't be returned to the status quo. So here,
certainly there are complexities, and at least at some point, our cases say it's the wrongdoer's problem, that the complexities can't be fully resolved. And so you do have this question of the circumstances under which the respondents here could have lawfully sold the stock, presumably at the times that are relevant.
But, of course, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that disgorgement would necessarily have been improper. I'm arguing that on the facts of this case, disgorgement constitutes a penalty within the meaning of 2462 and is barred by the 5-year statute of limitations. So
it constitutes a penalty because it doesn't have an offset for the pre-existing value he had, correct?
Well, the way I express it is because it doesn't return him to the status quo, which was the functional aspect of disgorgement that the Patricia Johnson court looked at in tending to carve out disgorgement from a penalty within the meaning of that statute. So my argument
is the status quo was not that he had those dollars, it was that he had those options. There's no way he can be restored to that.
And that's my point, that since there is no way.
Actually, maybe there is, but there wouldn't be of any value with it.
Well, there's no way he can be restored to that, and therefore a disgorgement under those circumstances, particularly where the property was come by honestly and the property truly had the value that it had, that in those narrow circumstances, a disgorgement order crosses a line into being a penalty for the purposes of 2462.
Let me put this hypothetically. Suppose it's clear that the best that Zacharias and Carley could have got in a sale truly exempt from Section 5 was $5. You would acknowledge they can't possibly use a a cost figure higher than $5, wouldn't you, or wouldn't you?
Well, I would agree with that if that's the best that they could do. But, you know, understand, Your Honors, this was a situation where in order to comply with the federal securities laws and sell them in an exempt transaction, all that would have been necessary would be for Mr. Zacharias and Mr. Carley's names to be added to the S-8 regulation.
Are you saying that there's no information that a registration statement under the 33 Act would have added to information already in the public sector?
Not only
in the public sector, but on the commission's books.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about a sale compliant with U.S. law, the only thing that had to be done was a post-effective amendment on the form S-8, which identified them as selling shareholders. This whole Rube Goldberg process was developed to deal with a perceived problem under Canadian law,
right?
Not under U.S. law. So they're the only...
I mean, that's a fine argument, but then why didn't they do what had to be done under U.S. law?
Well, because they thought that would create a problem for them in Canada, and they wanted to be compliant under both regulatory schemes.
Am I correct in thinking that it was about this issue of the value, the offsetting value, or the status quo ante value, that Mr. Quinn said you didn't put anything into evidence?
Well, you know, I think that I think there is evidence there wasn't anything. I mean, if your question is, did we put into evidence what sales of shares with restrictions would have brought, there was nothing put into evidence there.
Any alternative value for the disgorgement?
No, because there was no...
Well, you said something or other enough to inspire the commission to come up with its theory on why it should disregard the cost of exercising the options.
Well, you know, Judge Williams...
Or maybe they just spun that out of their
activity. I may hate myself in the morning for saying this, but in fairness to the commission,
we'll respect you.
The proceeds that the that Mr. Zacharias got, and I believe it's true for Mr. Carley, were net of the exercise price. So the profit or the loss that I am basing my argument on is the value of the property that Mr. Zacharias at least held and obtained legally and was really worth what it was worth. And so there is, this is not a situation.
So even though the commission constantly talks about proceeds, it really was applying a profits test in a somewhat narrow way.
In the most narrow way, but at least as far as Mr. Zacharias is concerned, what the record shows is that the proceeds that were distributed to him were net of the exercise price. And so to the extent that Your Honor was under a misimpression about that, we got that limited, you know, I mean, it was like 15 cents a share, and it was not a big deal, but they did it. But the real thrust of the argument was
the value
of
the options.
I'm sorry?
The value of the options. Right.
Basic, that's right. Assuming that there's, yes, basically that's correct. So our argument is not that Mr. Zacharias is entitled to get a credit for the exercise price because the proceeds were net of that. But he was entitled to get a credit for the value of the property that he had, that he came by lawfully, and that was truly worth the sales proceeds.
Just to get clear what was argued, that proposition you did argue. And did you have an opportunity to put in evidence of how that value might be calculated?
I think the value of that would be the value of
the... You think that, but that's not answering my question.
Did you make a proffer of any sort?
I'm not sure I understand the question in terms of a proffer of what.
I mean, I take it you said to the commission, at least, no, you've got to consider, however one cares, just use my terminology for simplicity's sake, the value of the options. I realize there are a lot of variations. You said, no, commission, you ought to consider that. And what did they say at that point? They said, forget it?
I don't think they addressed it. I think that they, I don't believe the commission addressed that issue at all, and just assumed that total proceeds, net of the exercise, flowed from the violation.
They didn't cut you off from putting in evidence of what this value would have been.
Well, I think the value is the same. The value is the market value.
I understand, but they didn't. They didn't say, forget about that. Whatever you've got, we don't care.
They didn't address the point at all. The evidence. There was no objection to evidence at the evidentiary hearing, but there didn't appear to be a question that if Mr. Zacharias owned 1,000 shares and the value of the share, or had options for 1,000 shares, and assuming let's assume zero as an exercise price, that his position was worth 1,000 times whatever the market value was.
Okay. So sure. Yes, I would be interested because I didn't hear any forfeiture argument. Okay, go ahead.
So in answer to your question about was I cut off? No, I wasn't cut off. I think that but the point was the value of Mr. Zacharias's position was the proceeds he obtained when he sold it. And that's what they required to be disgorged, net of the exercise price.
I'm sorry. So you didn't make a claim for any value other than the proceeds. See what I mean?
Well, I think that
net proceeds.
The argument that I made was that because there was no violation in obtaining the property, and that the Section 5 violation didn't affect the value of the property, that there were no ill-gotten gains. There were no gains obtained through any illegality.
Yeah, let me just, we're waiting for the return of Judge Ginsburg. I want to look at what the commission says. I mean, the commission's treatment of this is very simple. It says, these were the proceeds. That's it.
That's right. That was it.
Yeah. So it's unclear from the commission decision what the background state of play was.
Well, I think the record is fairly clear. I think that the commission, I thought the commission's decision was clear that they were not inclined to consider any of the special circumstances of this case. It was a complete, it's disgorgement. Disgorgement is outside the scope of Johnson v. SEC. Moved on to the next point. My argument is that basically one of the things that Johnson stands for is that labels matter a lot less than the underlying substance. And the underlying substance in this situation was such that ordering disgorgement didn't reimburse anyone and didn't return anyone to the status quo, and therefore, for purposes of Johnson, it was a penalty.
To recap part of the colloquy with Mr. Quinn, at least in your recollection, nobody ever addressed below whether the needing to sell under some exemption would have produced a reduction in the yield.
That's correct.
Oh, okay.
And, except that I did, in the sense that I pointed out below, as I at least to the ALJ, as I pointed out here, that all that was necessary to sell the stock in accordance with U.S. law, and it wouldn't have been an exemption, it would have been under a registration, was to add Mr. Zacharias's name to a post-effect amendment to the S-8. So there was no additional information that was going to come out relating to the company. There was none of that. So to that extent, I did raise the issue. Mm-hmm. And there was no particular burden. The reason they didn't do it was because they believed they had an issue under Canadian law and wanted to be compliant with both Canadian law and U.S. law, and they thought they had derived a procedure to do that. Yeah. In fact, you know, now while we argued that the violations didn't occur, but assuming the violations did, what happened was they thought with counsel that they had devised a procedure to be compliant with the laws both of Canada and the U.S., yeah, and with the benefit of hindsight and perhaps arguably a more insightful view, they were deemed to be wrong. It wasn't some scheme to evade anything. It was, okay. And indeed.
Thank you, Mr. Francisco.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'd hear from Mr. Quinn.
First, Mr. Carley.
Oh, okay. We can have that. Okay.
Counsel.
All right, Mr. Burge.
Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, I'd like to address Judge Ginsburg's question about the regulation that describes what has to be disclosed in the Form 10-K and what the Form 10-K actually said. It's in the record, Exhibit 446, and if all that was to be disclosed is the transaction between the company and the officer, to wit, the granting of an option, that's disclosed in the 10-K at Exhibit 446. It names Mr. Carley's name, Zacharias's name, the number of options, the value of those options, and the cost to the company. Now, I'd like to address the question that Judge Williams raised about this court's precedence on the topic of disgorgements and 2462. And essentially, that's Johnson, First City, and Banner Fund. And Bilzerian, sort of indirectly, it's not a 2462 case. But all of those other cases undoubtedly involve allegations of fraud, and in those other cases there's also a much more, as Judge Williams pointed out, nuanced effort to put a quantification on the loss to the harmed parties. And going back to the specific language in the Johnson opinion, the court says that a penalty under 2462 is any remedy that exceeds the amount of damage caused to the harmed parties by the defendant.
Yeah, my recollection is that Johnson also makes allusion to this ill-gotten gains.
It does, Your Honor. It's
hard to say what the real meaning of it is because the context there is not a disgorgement at all. So we don't have these interesting calculation problems.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's where I think Bilzerian is important.
Yes.
Because Bilzerian sort of answers that question that wasn't before Johnson, which is in the Bilzerian case, Mr. Bilzerian had been convicted of filing some false Form 14s and had made quite a bit of money by not disclosing the fact that he was involved. And in the underlying civil action in the district court, there was evidence of the impact of those non-disclosures on the amount of profit that he had obtained. In this case, Your Honor, the evidence all suggests that the stock was going up. It was riding the internet craze as well as the profits of the company. And there's no evidence anywhere, not even a hint or a suggestion, that any of the defendants had any role in moving that stock price up, thus breaking that causation that the court found so important in Bilzerian. In the Banner Fund case, Your Honor, it was more of a situation where there was all kinds of fraud and deceit about what the money was going to be used for, and the defendants just took the money and made off with it. So the Banner Fund doesn't provide the court, in my opinion, any guidance on this issue of how do you deal with the language in Johnson about harm caused, excuse me, damage caused to the harm parties. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Quinn, will we hear from you yet again, or I should say again, in light of what we've heard here about the calculations, the proffer, the proceedings below relevant to disgorgement?
Yes, Your Honor, two quick points. It seems to be what this is boiling down to is, should there have been some offset from disgorgement for either the value of the stock or the value of the options? And my point again is that they made no showing before the commission as to what that value might be. And a related clarification, to just a technical point, Judge Williams. On the Form S-8, the point was made or was asserted that they could have easily registered this reoffer pursuant to Form S-8 without any additional disclosure. That is not correct. If you look at Form S-8 and its provisions about using a reoffer prospectus, which is something that would be available, it requires you to include information required under Part 1 of Form S-3. And basically, that is much more extensive information than is disclosed under a Form S-8. And I think that gets back to the main point I'm trying to focus on is we don't know what if any, the value would have been.
Let's go back to the...
Yes.
You didn't, as I recall, in your brief, raise any waiver issue or forfeiture issue so far as this calculation problem is concerned.
Well, there are two aspects to this. With respect to their arguments about the value of the stock, which they did raise below, our answer was that because they were getting, and I talked about illegal proceeds, because they were getting money that was net of the exercise price of the stock. As to the value of the options, it was not until their brief before this court that a point was made about the options had some value. That was not made. In my recollection, it is a big record. In my recollection, they never argued to the commission that the options had some value and they should get the options back. What I saw in the record, they argued we should get the stock back or we should get credit for the value of the stock.
Well, that, I mean, in substance, that's the same, is it not? I mean, except for the out-of-pocket cost for exercising the option, that's the same.
Well, there's my distinction, Judge Williams, and you may not agree.
Because you can't sell the options except under the same circumstances that you could sell the stock, right?
I do have a distinct, yes, Judge Williams, you might disagree with this, but I do think there's a distinction, and it goes back to the commission's finding of a single ongoing illegal distribution. So under that's
the proposition. The whole thing is illegal, so anything they got is adequately causally connected to the proceeds.
Yes, as I was trying to say, the exercise price that was paid to Starnet, so they would get the stock. That exercise price was paid for with the profits from an illegal transaction.
I'm sorry, I thought that Mr. Zisser took that issue off the table because he said that
the
disgorgement number was net of that, so we don't have to worry about that.
That's true. I think that it's an additional reason. Okay, we're not worrying about it. That's an additional reason not to worry about it.
Right.
What are we worried about?
No reason not to worry about it.
I will be satisfied with one reason not to worry about it.
In other words, if I understand, the commission concedes that the claim was made that the value of the stock should be an offset, and it said without. It used substantially the reasoning we have here to say, no, it didn't say, oh, no, it's really the value of the options that would be relevant.
Your Honor, I do not believe the claim was that the value of the stock should be offset. I believe the claim was that because they were not being restored to the status quo, In other words, because they did not get the stock back, this was then barred by 2462. That was really what they were focusing on, rather than arguing for some offset in the calculation. They were arguing we can't
They were arguing that the properly calculated the disgorgement number is zero, right?
I'm not sure if that's the same or different than arguing that disgorgement should be barred by 2462. You would come to the same result. I think actually theoretically it's different.
If the commission looks at substance, that's what it would amount to.
Unless the court has any further questions.
No. Thank you, Mr. Quinn. Any further questions for the petitioners?
No.
Okay. Thank you all. The case is submitted.